Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
So welcome, guys, to the Midweek Takeaway. This is a special Midweek Takeaway with Charles Archer and Sapan Guy from Sovereign Metals. Recently, Charles wrote a report about Sovereign Metals and their project, Cassia. So I will welcome you both, gentlemen. How are you doing today?
Not too bad. How are you, Kev?
Yeah, we've just been discussing that Manchester United will play Liverpool in the FA Cup in 2 weeks' time. Sapan, as a big Manchester United fan, obviously he doesn't live in Manchester because otherwise he wouldn't support them. Yes, and myself as a Liverpool fan, and they've got Manchester City at the weekend, so it's going to be even more interesting. Mm. Anyway, back to the subject. I will say let the battle begin. Charles, the microphone is over to you. I will drop the microphone and let's see how it all pans out.
Wonderful. I'll pick the microphone up. Hi, Sapan. How are you? What have you been up to recently?
Good, Charles. Yeah, what have we been up to? A lot, if you look at our announcements page on our website. We've been trying to push out as much news as possible to keep investors and potential investors up to speed on what's going on with Cassia and with Sovereign on the ground.
So here's it. I've got a few questions that I've pre-prepared. I tend to go off on a tangent after about 5 minutes, don't worry. But I always start with this one because I think this is really important. There's roughly 100 junior resource companies on the London market. And as a general rule, most people investing will pick sort of 6 or 7 they want to invest in. Why should an investor looking at Sovereign Metals pick you for part of their portfolio?
So we've got this positioning of Sovereign Metals that we're trying to explain to the market, which is we would be the largest producer, the lowest cost producer, and with the lowest emissions in producing two critical minerals from deposit. I don't know how many of those 100 or so other companies could boast those type of but look, essentially we do have a tier one deposit. We are gunning to become a tier one company, and so, you know, we'd welcome anyone who wants to join us for that ride.
So Cassia is the flagship of the company, and it's a rutile graphite deposit. Now, one of the really interesting things to this deposit is it seems to be unique in terms of geology worldwide, which is why you can boast, it's going to be lowest cost. It's going to be an amazing asset. But what about this deposit is geologically unique?
So outside of the scale, I mean, look, currently the mineralized zone. So this isn't our permitted area. This is not the exploration license. This is the mineralized zone. Right, the valuable stuff already covers 200 square kilometers of ground.
Wow.
Put that into context for those who aren't so au fait with square kilometers, etc. That's about 4 Manhattan Islands worth of area. So that's a pretty big.
Crazy.
And it's all at surface, right? So it's all starting from a couple of centimeters of topsoil all the way down. We've only really drilled down to about 30 odd meters because after that, we hit a hard rock. The stuff that we're concentrating on is all soft rock. And what I really mean by that, it's actually a material called saprolite. It's like compacted soil almost. So you could, you know, if you wanted, grab a whole bunch of this stuff in your fist and just crush it right there and then. It's not hard rock that needs drilling, blasting, crushing, and grinding to get to a point where you can then hopefully liberate some minerals out of it. Those minerals are already liberated. So the rutile in crystal form and the graphite in flake form already sit within the soil. All we need to do is wash away the soil and we're left with the valuable stuff. It's really that simple.
Presumably operating costs would be like much, much lower. And CapEx as well, presumably as well. Capital expenditure would be also much, much lower. If you're literally just not even having to do the blasting, you're just digging out with a spade almost.
No, totally. And look, our PFS was based on us hydro mining the project. It is that simple. We're not looking at going much deeper than 14 odd meters per pit. The average is probably 5 meters. We do find what you might find interesting is the highest grade rutile sits right at surface. And then it starts to slowly decrease as we go beyond the 5 meters. Beyond that 5 meters, the graphite grade starts to pick up. So it's almost an inverse. So it makes complete sense for us to just go ahead and keep going down to a point where we start hitting, you know, that hard rock, and we wouldn't. And then we're talking about a configuration that we just don't want to get.
Don't want to deal with. Yeah, but again, given you've got 200 square kilometers and you're still drilling, I suspect you'll have enough to keep you going for a fair few years. Well, I mean, the PFS you were talking, was it like 15, 25-year life of mine? But it seemed very conservative what you were talking about in that PFS.
Yeah, so we modeled 25 years.
It was 25, yeah.
Of resource. That's not to do with the size of the resource. That's not to do with the chemistry, the geology, the financeability or anything. That simply was because, you know, after 25 years, as you well know, having looked at many of these mine models, is whether you're a retail investor or an institutional investor, are you going to worry about what the cash flows look like in years kind of 25 and beyond?
Probably not, no.
Key point is after those 25 years, we've only mined 30% of the resource. So when you're looking at this from a global perspective as a strategically positioned supplier of both rutile and graphite into the future, this thing could go on for easily 50, 75 years.
Well, I mean, it was only based on 30% of the current known mineralization at the time. And then since then, you've done a lot of drilling. I mean, I noticed you released an RNS at the start of this month, so 1st of February, where the extension to rutile and graphite, you had a massive extension, you know, beyond even what you had there. So in the, can you tell me what, I mean, in like the pre-feasibility study figures, you had a $1.6 billion net present value. The mineral resource was 17.9 million tons of rutile at 1.01%, 24.4 million tons of graphite, 1.32%. This resource increase means those numbers are going to be even better, right?
Well, look, what we did was we went further south beyond the known mineralized resource area, poked some holes in the ground and tried to see whether the rutile and the graphite continued. And what we found is you've got another 8 kilometers. Well, let's put it in this context. We went around 8 kilometers further and it did continue. We haven't continued beyond those 8 kilometers. We've now, you know, we've decided to send a few recon teams up towards the north end as well. Or within our exploration package, you know, the mineralization continues on that side as well. So look, this thing is already tier one. I don't think there's another tier that we could describe it as.
Tier zero. create your own tier.
Exactly, but it's just immensely huge.
In terms of exploration, you've locked up all the exploratory tenure around you then, presumably.
Correct. I mean, look, having done this many times before, it was the first thing we did as soon as we found signatures of the titanium.
So Savan, I mean, my question is, if you're like trying to compare Cassia to, you know, to other assets based on, you know, like a gold or a copper equivalent, you know, you're looking at maybe 20 million ounces of copper as an equivalent, or 30 to 40 million ounces of gold. I mean, just very roughly, that's 5 to 6 Javierons, you know, the Greatland gold deposit. Why is the market asleep to this opportunity?
Look, I think there's a number of reasons for that, notwithstanding the overriding market sentiment, which it's rutile. And it's the first rutile deposit that's been found in 70 years. So you haven't had many other companies come along and tell you about their rutile deposits in the last 70 years because... Yeah. There really have been none. And the connection between rutile and it being the highest grade, purest naturally found form of a titanium oxide hasn't really gone into the market. You know, the market loves talking about titanium, for example, because it sounds sexy. It's used in so many other industries, you know, everything from aerospace, defense, your iPhones, if you're lucky enough to have a new one, through to paint, welding. But no one goes back and thinks, right, how is this titanium found?
Yeah.
And the reality is most of it is sourced from ilmenite, which is only about 30, 40, 50% TiO2. And only 5% of it is actually sourced from rutile because there just isn't enough rutile on the planet. And therefore, having found something that is rutile, it's not really resonated, I think, with many, many investors out there. And you have a that actually has a graphite co-product, a byproduct. And all of a sudden, you've got no peers. There's nothing that can be comparable to Cassia on simply a commodity perspective
or yeah. geological perspective. Again, I think this is a one of a kind deposit, isn't it?
Exactly. And I think, you know, I think that, and we can a bit more about it, but the fact that, you know, Rio Tinto decided after doing a certain amount of DD on the project and the company and us that, you know, we were worth at least investing $40 million for 15% of the shares in Sovereign, but to just how unique, how strategic, how critical, how tier one this deposit actually is.
So, I mean, you've jumped the gun because I had Rio Tinto questions in the far-flung future, but we'll go straight there, I think, having mentioned it. So, are you a little bit, if you haven't heard of Rio Tinto, you might as well stop listening now. But a little bit of context, Rio Tinto is a massive, massive mining major. It's on the FTSE 100 as well as other indices. And Rio Tinto is, I think it's worth like $120 billion-ish at the moment. It's the largest titanium feedstock producer. It's involved in pretty much every mineral you can imagine. It produced 1,200 kilotons per annum of titanium dioxide in 2022. It's invested in titanium projects across Africa. And the basic point is, this is what attracted me to Sovereign Metals. This is the issue, right? It's that Rio Tinto will not let this deposit go. I mean, you would assume that at some point they'll want to increase that 15%. They've got an option to go up to 20%, don't they? Or just under. And then to go up to 100, you would imagine a buyout at some point. What do you reckon, Pam?
Well, look, I'm not going to comment on what Rio's plans are. Very much a question for Rio Tinto. Speaking of which, what's interesting is they released their annual results, I think, last week. And during their own investor pack has Cassia within their most promising pipeline.
Well, what more could you want than that?
That's not a bad signal. But look, the reality is if you talk to the Rio guys, they understand that they are, at this point in time, a 15% shareholder. What they're doing is, through that 15% shareholding, what they provide Sovereign is all that IP, all that intellectual property, all that know-how, all that expertise, all their experience within the titanium division, as well as all the expertise they have within battery minerals for our graphite. And so what we're doing with Rio right now is basically, we had the PFS numbers, the pre-feasibility study numbers, out in September last year. And let me make it clear, those numbers were solely Sovereign numbers. They were not, they had no Rio Tinto input whatsoever. Now what we're doing is taking those Sovereign-led assumptions and looking at them through the lens of a Rio Tinto. I want to stress, not the balance sheet of a Rio Tinto, so we're not Rolls-Royce-ing everything up, but we are talking about using some of the technological know-how, some of the geological, hydrogeological expertise, tailings management expertise, and those kind of really, really niche subjects that Rio Tinto is all over, and looking at our PFS through that lens and figuring out, okay, when we decide to do a DFS, what do we really need to concentrate on?
Yeah, how do you improve the economics even further? I mean, there's a joint technical committee between the two of you, which kind of makes, you know, okay, somebody's in charge, but it is a kind of a joint decision-making process, but with somebody making a decision at the end. Maybe explain how that works in a second. But I mean, if you're looking at those pre-feasibility numbers, just under $600 million capital expenditure to get to first production, operating expenditure at $404 a ton. Those are already the lowest that you're going to get, you know, pretty much anywhere. And the fact you're trying to upgrade those now anyway. And then on top of that, because of the nature of the deposit, as you say, it's rutile and not ilmenite, it's going to be far less carbon intensive. In fact, I mean, I did the research. I mean, isn't Cassia, it's going to be the lowest carbon footprint of any major producer, you know, based on those numbers that you've got. Is that right? Or is that not? Sorry. I couldn't find anything else that was lower.
Let's boil it down to something that the listeners absolutely, you know, au fait with. Rutile, right? Ends up as TiO2, ends up as pigment that goes into your tin of paint, right? Now, that tin of paint, when you go to the DIY store and pick it up, if you were to pick that up now, the titanium dioxide component to get that in that tin of paint, for every kilogram of that in that tin of paint, you've released about 8 kilograms of carbon dioxide emissions.
Right.
If you were to use cassia rutile in that same tin of paint, you could halve that.
Okay, that's perfect. That's something people can understand.
And that's the rutile end. Now let's talk about the graphite side of things. We're all looking to buy or to electrify our vehicle fleet, right? We're all looking to buy electric vehicles at some point. Whether we're forced to or we want to is a different podcast.
Doesn't matter. We're going to be forced to, so we need to invest accordingly. But yes.
But look, if we're doing it to save the planet, let's just think back and go, okay, well, 30% of the carbon footprint of the battery in that electric vehicle is from graphite. And that's predominantly because the graphite comes from China in a synthetic form.
Yeah.
And every kilogram of graphite in your electric vehicle, China's released 20 kilograms of carbon dioxide emissions.
Yes.
If you were to use Kaseya's graphite in that same electric vehicle battery, you'd be releasing 0.2 kilograms. So it's literally a 99% decrease in the carbon emissions to get your electric vehicle battery inputs.
Okay, this is just speculation, but we're talking, you know, if you have such green credentials, when you come to signing an offtake agreement with, you know, whoever it's going to be, whatever auto manufacturer, does that then mean they could pay a premium to the, you know, standard market price of graphite in order to be able to market their cars as greener? Is that something that you think is possible?
So what we're seeing, and I think, you know, with all things green, usually the EU is always the front runner in these processes. And what we're seeing in the EU in industry is, the way we like to term it, at least, is decarbonization is essentially a license to do business now. Policy making sure that, you know, regulation is making sure that all your industry players within Europe are having to look at their supply chains and lowering the CO2 emissions. And you can go ahead and look at tens of thousands of companies, you know, announcements or reports, sustainability reports, and they'll all say exactly that. You know, whether you're a Boeing, an Airbus, a Rolls-Royce, a BMW, a Colgate, and you use titanium dioxide in your toothpaste to make it white, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Guys are saying, we are going to reduce the CO2 footprint of our supply chains all the way up the stream. So even though now you don't see that premium in the pricing, it's going to come.
Okay, that's good to hear. I mean, rutile and titanium, not worried about the pricing at all. In fact, I'm speculating in the past that China might impose an export ban on titanium, among other metals. But graphite is one of those, like, it's been pushed down so much by that synthetic graphite from China. Manufacturing capacity is huge. So it's nice to know you have some sort of economic moat for that aspect of the business. I want to turn quickly to logistics, because the deposit is based in Malawi, which is adjacent to Zambia, but in a country probably many people listening here aren't that familiar with. I think the logistics for the project is pretty sound, but, you know, what's surrounding you? You've got the Nacala Logistics Corridor, you have the railway running nearby. How difficult would it be for you, or say you and Rio Tinto together, to develop this deposit into a producing mine?
From a logistics perspective, I need probably 5 to 6 kilometers of rail, which is going to cost, what, about $6 million, which is all built into our CapEx.
Right.
And I'm fully connected all the way to Africa's deepest water port, which is in operation with lots of capacity at Nacala today. So there's the answer. We also know that it's going to cost us less than $100 a ton for a product that sells for, you know, today for $2,000 a ton to actually get it there. So not a rounding error, but easily achievable.
In terms of just capacity at the port, capacity on the railway, loads of capacity, no problems there. It's not going to be a case of you buy all your 6 kilometers and you realize you can't get it out.
So let's just talk about the Nacala Logistics Corridor.
Sorry. I do know this, but I think it's important for people listening to have it highlighted.
So look, the actual railway itself it's been there using a technical word here, yonks, right? it actually goes through goes from Zambia through Malawi and from Mozambique through Malawi and back into Mozambique and out to the port of Nacala. It was refurbished about 15 odd years ago by the big Brazilian iron ore producer and coal producer Vale, because they had a old coal province in Mozambique which they wanted to unlock and link to the seaborne market. The easiest way to do that was to refurbish the Nacala Logistics Corridor. So part of the agreement, given that it goes through 3 different countries, was that each of those countries gets an allocation of capacity on the rail. For Malawi, that capacity is 3.5 million tons out of a total capacity of 30 million tons. Currently, Malawi probably uses about 250,000 tons of that capacity. So we're looking at 500,000 tons. And, you know, let's just say if someone wanted to produce 1 million tons, 2 million tons from Kassia, there's ample capacity.
That's no problem at all.
To handle all of that.
Good. Now, so moving on to maybe not jurisdictional risk, but the jurisdiction itself. Again, you know, I think if we were talking about Zambia, we probably wouldn't even need to talk about it because everyone would know what's going on. But Malawi being pretty much at peace since independence in 1964, the mining industry just isn't a big, you know, they want to grow it, but the mining industry in the country is not a big part of the GDP yet. Having said that, His Excellency President Lazarus Chakwera said in front of a US General Assembly, you know, so not in front of a small audience, he said, "The recent discovery in Malawi of the largest deposit of rutile in the world means that Malawi's economic rise is imminent." That would suggest that it's probably the most important mineral deposit in the country. How important is this deposit in, you know, compared to Africa in general, would you say?
Well, look, it's no surprise that, you know, the largest Africa mining and infrastructure project today is the Simandou iron ore project in Guinea.
Yes.
Also owned by Rio Tinto. And it's no surprise that we are using some of the individuals who have worked at Simandou or at Kassia, whether that be in the social perspective. One of our non-executive directors, Nigel Jones, is former Rio Tinto and was the former managing director of Simandou. So, you know, we're getting the A-team behind an A-team, an A-class project here.
Okay, you're talking about the A-team behind the A-team. I only talked about this privately not so long ago. I don't want to talk about other companies you're involved in that are currently listed or active, but could you say, is there a couple of examples you can give of where the team at Sovereign Metals, where they've had successes in the past?
Yeah, so look, individually, all of us have worked at either blue chip mining companies, you know, BHP, for example, Rio Tinto. We've worked on huge projects that have ultimately either gone into development or been sold. We've worked at some of the more well-known mining banks. Myself, my background is at Standard Bank, which is our largest bank, where I did a number of project financings of now very well-known mines as well. And then I did a stint at BMO Capital Markets, which is very well-known for financing a lot of assets. In fact, while I was there, I think we won Global Finance's mining investment banking team of the year for about 6 years running.
Wonderful. All while you were there, presumably. The day you left, they stopped winning awards.
Funny. It's funny that happened. I mean, I don't know why, but, you know. But look, just looking at my, you know, I don't want to go on about my CV, but I have been involved in numerous M&As across Africa in the mining space. The other day I was trying to, you know, total them up, and it was something like, you know, $12, $13 billion worth of M&A. Lots of financings, equity, debt, project finance. You total them up, it's probably about $3, $4, $5 billion there as well, right? So, and I'm not the core of the team. The core of the team is our MD, Frank Egar, who's done, you know, taken projects from where we are now through to development and put them on the map in sub-Saharan Africa numerous occasions. So we've got, you know, we've got a team behind him who have also developed projects all throughout Africa, you know, and specifically around where we are, you know, around Zambia, around Mozambique. So it's, like I said, we've really got the A-team behind this.
Got the A-team. I imagine all of you in front of a DVD poster back in the day. But no, he's not laughing, but he is smiling for anyone listening. But this is a key point, because I wanted to bring it up. Though, you know, the investment case, I think, for the average investor looking at this, and I know you don't want to talk about, you know, what Rio's perspective is, but Rio Tinto is the king of the titanium market. They own 15%. They've got the rights to first refusal, should we wish to sell the asset. I think it's very likely Rio Tinto will want to take it on. But let's say that they don't want to. Let's say in that unlikely event that they decide, you know what, we want to stick on our 15 or 20%. This is a team that is perfectly capable of bringing this mine into production, in my view. With, you know, with the knowledge that they have, with the money that they have. And then on top of that, I mean, the other thing is they have millions of dollars still in the bank. So if you're listening now and thinking, oh, but, you know, what are they going to do next? What they're going to do next is they're going to improve this pre-feasibility study. They're going to go down the definitive feasibility study. And at some point between now and the next 2 to 3 years, anyone investing, not financial advice, should be feeling very happy let me talk a little bit about this, because you've got the definitive feasibility study out, and that came out some time ago.
Pre-feasibility.
But you haven't started the definitive feasibility study yet. Exactly.
No.
So my question is, what exactly are you up to? And we're talking, I mean, I'll use the technical word, you're upgrading the pre-feasibility study. But what does that entail at the moment?
Exactly what I said before. It entails, the one big thing that Rio's brought to the table here is 150 years worth of global mining experience. If there's anything that is, new technology, new know-how, ways to more efficient, effective ways to mine, process, sell your product, then Rio, it's going to be in Rio's wheelhouse. Mm. And what we're doing is tapping that wheelhouse and taking all that information in-house at Sovereign to understand, how do we mine this better? How much do we mine? Where and when and how and why do we build the actual processing part and the processing infrastructure? And who do we sell this product to as well?
You've had, you've non-binding memorandums of understanding, Mitsui, Chemours, Haskell. Are these not going to be the people you eventually sell to, most likely?
Well, look, those MOUs have all been non-binding, and we continue to have discussions with everyone in the space. What I will say is, as the more MOUs or the more offtake agreements that we began looking at signing, the hotter Rio Tinto got on the project.
Yes, well, it's always the way, isn't it? It's kind of like jealousy. Like, this is just a rutile asset, and then suddenly everybody wants to talk to you. Hang on, they should be talking to us too. But
that's not exactly, kind of any that shouldn't blow anyone's mind, because the investment agreement in itself, which is public, stipulates that if Rio Tinto were to become operator of the project, they would have 40% of the marketing rights.
Yeah.
All products coming out of Casilla. And they also have a preemptive on, or they have a veto right on us doing any offtake agreements with anyone outside of, I guess, their own supply chains, which, if you're Rio Tinto, you're supplying to the whole market anyway.
Indeed. So it's all good. I mean, you're talking about rutile. I mean, one of the other rutile deposit that investors will have heard of is Sierra Rutile. But I think, this is not top of my head. It must only have like 2 or 3 years of mine life left. Like, it must be running out relatively soon. And yet you haven't got started yet. Is that right? Sorry, I don't know. It must be. It can't have much longer left to go.
So let's just look at the rutile market, right? Let's take a step back. The high quality titanium feedstock is serviced by about 8 million tons of ilmenite and about 500,000 tons of rutile today.
Yeah.
Not because ilmenite is more preferred, is cheaper, is better. It's because there's just more of it in the world. There's not. 5 years ago, it wasn't 500,000 tons. It was about 750,000 tons. Those 250,000 tons of rutile have disappeared because of depleting reserves, because of lowering grades within the rutile industry. In 5 or 6 years from now, that's going to be 300,000 tons. In 10 years from now, you're going to lose half of that 500,000 tons out of the rutile space. Now, I'm saying that based on projected numbers as of September 2023.
Okay.
The reality is about 200,000 tons of rutile came from two main sources: a company called Base Resources, which mines ilmenite and has a big rutile byproduct. They used to, sell 60,000 to 80,000 tons of rutile from their Kwale project. Kwale's on record as finishing in December 2024. So that's 10 months from this.
Yeah.
That takes out your 80,000 tons. That left Sierra Rutile, 120,000 tons of rutile in the market. What's happened since September last year is they've had a few hiccups with the Sierra Leone government. Their project is based in Sierra Leone, and they've essentially put it on care and maintenance. So that 130,000 tons, that does come from Sierra Rutile, from a project called Area 1, which, again, has about 3 years left of it. Anyway.
3 years, is it?
Okay. In production for 50-odd years.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. It must be nearly depleted.
Yeah. So it's got 3 more years, but it's not producing today. So you've got a massive supply deficit hitting the rutile market today.
But surely, anybody in that market then is going to be desperately searching. And, you know, this isn't, you know, saying Sovereign Metals, you know, already got the Golden Crown, which it does. But will that market not be replaced? It's just so rare that it's too difficult to find new deposits, or maybe too difficult to find them in time.
Yeah, correct. And just because of the geology of rutile. So what rutile is, it's basically ilmenite that's already been processed by Mother Nature. We don't have the time for Mother Nature to upgrade all the ilmenite in the world to rutile. So, you know, rutile is found very few and far between. I don't know what the market would have done before we found Cassia. It's an interesting... it would be interesting to think what it would have done for the ilmenite market. But all we can do is just get our product to market as soon as we can and to the right customers as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm almost running out of questions. I mean, it's difficult, right? Because the majority of the time, I tend to, you know, end with talking about like risk factors. There doesn't seem to be many here, to be honest. I mean, Malawi, safe country, very little jurisdictional risk, management team, great. Tens of millions still in the bank, so you're not going to be like stressing out about a placing anytime soon. Again, can't guarantee that, but it's very unlikely. You've got Rio Tinto involved, you've got the largest rutile deposit, you've got the second largest graphite deposit, and this in the world, not just Africa, and yet somehow the market doesn't seem to accept it. I mean, if you look at the share price action over the past kind of year and a half, it's kind of bobbed along this sort of 22, 23, 24 peak. And I guess what's going to happen next is you're going to reach this inflection point now where presumably the definitive feasibility study will start, hopefully at some point in 2024. And then the share price just, you know, people should start to realize this is one of the, you know, best assets you could be investing in right now. Do you think that's reasonable timeline-wise, DFS starting 2024?
Look, I don't want to speculate on that.
Sorry. I don't want to put you in the hot seat. I know, you can't sometimes.
You know, some may argue that the fact that we've just flatlined over the last year has been we've outperformed the market.
That's fair, actually. Many of them were down 80%, so maybe I'm speaking too soon.
I think there's obviously question marks when a new project comes along and tells you that it's the biggest, the best, you know, of everything. And what I would say to people is, look, you've got a good team here who know what they're doing. You've got involved. They tend to know what they're doing, and they tend to not, you know, put chips on the table without having done their homework. So that should give you comfort on that. This is rutile. It is graphite. It's a completely unique deposit. But, you know, if you're looking for a unique investment rather than the same old usual kind of spiels you may be getting, then please look at Sovereign Metals from that perspective. Malawi, you're hearing a lot more about Malawi. You know, people may not be familiar with the country. It is it is part of the Commonwealth. You know, it's got about 20 odd million people. It's quite populous. Is Malawi, and mining is dead center of its economic development strategy.
Yeah,
you know, you gave that quote from the president. You know, but a few weeks ago they had the State of Nation address, and he again talked about Cassia, and he used the words, and these are not my words, game changer. Right.
Game changer. Oh, yes, I saw that. Yeah.
You know, when people worry about, you know, the more esoteric jurisdictions in the world and, you know, thinking about whether they should invest in them or not, well, you could do a lot worse invest in a country which is gunning for the success of the project to the point they've got their own governmental committee of different ministers who are simply there to make sure that Cassia gets through the entire permitting process and everything.
It's the flagship though for Malawi, isn't it? I guess in some ways, the only other company that I've covered is much smaller than Kango with Songwei Hill, but you know, again, much, much smaller. You could argue that it successfully developed will be kind of Malawi's way to kind of market itself as, you know, a new mining location to come to.
Correct.
Sorry to interrupt you.
No, you're absolutely right. And look, I mean, there's what, currently about six or seven listed mining companies in Malawi. I mean, and in terms of attracting financing, you know, attracting development capital, there's a company called Lotus Resources, who most listeners may not be aware of because it's an ASX-listed uranium company, but they are looking to restart the Kayelekera uranium mine in Malawi. And they announced a $30 million equity investment just last week, which, you know, was done in an accelerated fashion and got done pretty quickly. And from what I hear, was a very successful financing for them. So, you know, there is appetite to see Malawi actually really get on the mining map now.
Excellent, excellent. Well, do you know, I've run out of questions. I think you've given a very good account of yourself. And, you know, Sovereign's one of these companies where I think if you have a long-term investing mindset and you don't want to jump in or jump out every couple of weeks, if you buy shares, you wait 3 to 5 years. Might be sooner. It might be a lot sooner, depending on what Rio Tinto chooses to do. But this is an investment which will pay dividends in time, or at least capital gains. Anyway, this was Japan Guy at Sovereign Metals. This has been a wonderful chat. Sapan, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thank you, Charles, and thank you, Sapan. It was a very good lesson. Basically, my takeaways is Charles thinks there's absolutely no risk involved in this, which is wonderful, which I say that obviously tongue-in-cheek. There is obviously an element of risk, but I actually think the biggest risk is not buying the shares and waiting.
Yeah.
Okay, so actually patience is the biggest risk in this particular stock, because from my perspective, and obviously Sapan can't say it, Rio are going to take this project. They're going to pay a lot of money for it, and shareholders are going to be all very, very happy about the whole thing. And I don't see any other result, to be honest. So my two penneth worth, obviously you guys are more educated than I am in terms of this particular scenario, but that's all good. Thank you again for your time, Sapan and Charles, and we look forward to speaking to you in the near future.
It's been a pleasure.
Yes, bye.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.